Taking a look at brain power now with our guest, Asenath LaRue, who is a senior scientist at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She's a neuropsychologist at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, specializes in research into cognitive aging, and I tell you, it's on the minds of a lot of people, including, I'm sure, our baby boomers, who are a lot of people getting into that age range where Alzheimer's and those kinds of problems begin to develop. So we're visiting with her about this whole area and something called the 1-2-3 of brain power, which I find kind of interesting too. And certainly as we visit with her and you have questions, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And Asenath, is that correct?
That's right. That was the first thing I was going to do is is help correct the pronunciation.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I'm, and you know, my last name is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R, and it's often mispronounced.
Right. Spoken like a neuropsychologist, I always give people the mnemonic that it sounds a little like a Zenith television, and that helps.
Well, mnemonics, does that help us with our memories?
It certainly does. You know, they're tried and true, been around for literally centuries, and if you make the commitment to using mnemonics and you have a normally aging or healthy brain, they will work.
How do we, you know, I think the Alzheimer's Institute estimates that there's about 5 million Americans with memory and language problems caused by Alzheimer's disease. And that's supposed to increase by a lot.
Yeah. The main source of the increase is just that because of health changes and health practices in our country, so many more of us are getting the opportunity to grow old. We don't necessarily think that the incidence of Alzheimer's disease or the likelihood that a person will get it is increasing. It's just that so many more Americans are living into that age range when we enter the prime risk period for Alzheimer's disease.
And that prime risk period is?
Starting age 75 and up. And certainly it becomes a common condition by the time people reach their mid-80s, where it's estimated that 30 to 50% of people in their mid-80s have some kind of cognitive impairment syndrome, not always Alzheimer's disease, but that is the most common cause.
And, you know, I mentioned the baby boomers, and I'm sure every baby boomer at one time or another over the last year or two has probably thought about this. But even people in their 30s.
Right.
Are worried about this.
It's true. I remember one talk I gave this spring. There were quite a few people in the audience, and it was on brain fitness. And as I was leaving and the talk was over and it'd been kind of a lunchtime talk, a man came up to me who'd been helping to serve, and he had to be only in his 20s, and he wanted to know what he could do because of everyday forgetfulness and inattentiveness, and he says, I've got to start to deal with this now. So it's not something that is only a concern about older people.
And, you know, it's just thinking about it, I have trouble from time to time, and probably we all do. It's probably more apparent for me because I'm on the air talking sort of off the cuff a lot to people, but I'll have trouble pulling up a word, and I worry about that and wonder about that. Is that going to be, you know, is this the first sign or what have you?
Right. And I think just from my listening to you, Larry, you do very well. And I'd be curious to know what sorts of prompts you give yourself or what little devices you've developed over the years to help to keep your memory sharp. But certainly the things that most people complain about by the time they're in their 50s are two types of things. One is just remembering the specifics of recent experiences. People's names. names, the titles of books, the actor's name in the movie that you just saw two nights ago. The memory for that kind of recent detail, while it's still there, becomes a little less reliable and kind of annoying. And then at the same time, people report some increased problems with word finding, just coming up with that specific word that you wanted to use when you wanted to use it. And for normally aging people, both of these things stay at the merely annoying level. You know, they don't really yeah. stop you from doing anything important, and people joke with each other about it. My husband and I tag team to remember people's names, and between the two of us, you know, we do not too badly. So people learn to cope with that when it's a normal aging thing, but it is a little bit annoying.
Yeah, it is a little. My wife's a little younger than me, and her memory is much better on names and so forth. And
she'll be happy to hear you say that.
So I sometimes have to rely on her for names are sometimes hard for me to call up.
Yes, names are particularly hard, and there are some neurobiological reasons for that, we think. But it is a very, very annoying thing. But this is an area where mnemonics can help quite mm-hmm. a bit. And these are all kind of well-known memory strategies. But if you are newly introduced to someone and it's important for you to learn and remember that person's name, an important first step is to simply make sure you heard the name correctly in the first place to focus mm-hmm. your attention. And then if you can, in some not too awkward a way, find an opportunity to repeat the name back mm-hmm. at that instant, that's helpful. And then if you can form any kind of association, it sounds like, reminds you of, or make a visual association, all of those things elaborate on the encoding or learning of the name and pay off later when you try to recall that name.
We're talking about brain power today with our guest, Asenath LaRue, who is a senior scientist at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, a neuropsychologist at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, specializing in research into cognitive aging. Certainly, if you want to join us, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Now, a neuropsychologist, what does a neuropsychologist do?
Well, a neuropsychologist looks at relationships between brain function and everyday behavior. And you can do that either in terms of trying to understand normal relationships between brain function and behavior, or clinically, you're looking at people who may have experienced some kind of brain disease or brain injury, which is impacting their everyday behavior. But basically, you're a psychologist who specializes in working with people who've had a brain injury.
And you do a lot of research.
Yes, a lot of research.
Go ahead and talk about, can you give us some examples
sure.
of some of them before we take
sure.
some calls here?
Yeah, one of our ongoing, the largest study that we're doing through the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, Dr. Mark Sager and all of our colleagues there, is called the RAP Project, the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. And that is a long-term prospective study where we've enrolled the sons and daughters of people who have Alzheimer's disease. And all these sons and daughters are healthy at this point. They're between 40 and 65, and our plan is to follow them up in a naturalistic way over decades. And our aim is to kind of see what lifestyle factors, what health factors, and so on end up being associated with staying healthy mentally versus which factors may be predisposing or connected with Alzheimer's disease down the line. So that's a big ongoing study. And we've also just completed a smaller scale pilot study of a brain wellness intervention, a year-long project called Take Charge, where we were working with people who have mild cognitive impairment, trying to do all sorts of everyday lifestyle enhancements to keep people going and keep their memories as strong as possible.
Hmm. Well, Jerry in Sparta has a question for you, Asenath, so let's go there. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for your guest. My mother is 82 years old, lives in Fort Myers, Florida, and we're noticing some beginning stages of dementia. Just to put it in context, my grandma passed away when she was 96, had very severe dementia and Alzheimer's. We encouraged my mom to visit her doctor, and we heard about a new medicine that's available for early stages of Alzheimer's. She asked her doctor. He told her he'd known her a long time. If she had dementia, he would know it, that he could look in her eyes and tell whether or not she had this faraway look. He told her to totally dismiss that, to not think about it anymore, and to go home and not worry. We were a bit concerned about that, wondered if that's normal in terms of diagnosis, and just kind of wondered what your thinking was and if this new medication that's being advertised is anything we should look into. I thank you for your calls, for your research. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Now, I'm not sure about the medication, unfortunately, but go ahead.
Right. I'm not certain what medication it is, but the story that you just related with your mother, Jerry, is one that we hear quite a bit. And I think it must be frustrating perhaps to you as family members a long distance away to know how best to help with this. But there are a lot of advantages, I think, to a person to getting an accurate diagnosis if this is beginning Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia. And, you know, one thing you might consider would be to see if she can go to a memory diagnostic center, a dementia diagnostic center there in her home state. There are several such centers associated, for example, with the University of Florida, and try to get, if you will, a second opinion on this important question. I think sometimes in primary care, many primary care physicians say it is an awkward thing for them to try to broach the topic of dementia, especially in long-term clients with whom, you know, they may have developed a strong connection over the years. So sometimes you just have to kind of push for a specialty referral to get to the bottom of this.
And thank you again very much for calling. We're visiting today with Asena LaRue, a senior scientist at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and we're talking about brain fitness. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking brain power today with Asena LaRue, who is a senior scientist at the University of Wisconsin, neuropsychologist at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, specializing in research into cognitive aging. Really happy to have her with us today to talk with you. And with me, give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And one emailer wondered if there was any evidence that children of Alzheimer's disease are at greater threat of memory loss.
I mean the adult sons and daughters,
right,
of people. There is evidence that there is somewhat increased risk to people who have a close family member, including a parent. Now, the risk is generally highest in families where the disease has an early onset. And by that I mean age 60 or lower.
Wow.
And this accounts for only a small minority of the affected families or individuals in this country, but it seems to have a somewhat different genetic underpinning and to carry with it a higher risk than to close family members. The more garden variety of Alzheimer's disease, which has a much later onset, there is somewhat increased risk to family members, but not as strong as in the early onset cases.
Rose in Stoughton has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Rose.
Oh, hi. I was calling to ask a question about my father-in-law. He has COPD and slowly dying from it. He's on oxygen, and he's been on prednisone for a year. And all of a sudden, he gets confused, and doesn't know what he's doing, or he stops and stares. So they took him to the hospital. They did an MRI, everything. He didn't have a stroke or anything like that. So I was wondering if he can come on that suddenly, because in the last month he's been getting a little bit more confused, and his oxygen levels were fine.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, Asenath?
Well, I might ask Rose, how old is your son-in-law?
Oh, no,
father-in-law.
It's my, father-in-law.
I'm sorry.
He's 82.
82 years old. Well, we know that the way a person's everyday cognition functions is influenced by their general state of health. And conditions such as COPD and a variety of cardiovascular conditions are ones in which it's pretty common, perhaps, to have some undermining of everyday cognition associated with those disorders. Now, normally, a condition such as true dementia or Alzheimer's disease would not come on so suddenly that you would notice within a period of a month or so. Sometimes what happens is a person may have gradually been developing the brain changes of this condition, and then on top of that will have some other medical condition that gets worse, and it's almost as though it uncovers the underlying brain disorder. So again, in a particular case like this, it sounds like there are several medical things going on that may be contributing, but it would just be very important to continue to work closely with your father-in-law's doctor to try to get to the bottom of this.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Rose. Rich in Chippewa Falls, we turn to you. Hi, Rich.
Hi there. I've got a memory exercise that I've incorporated into my daily routine, where I'll just change hands with whatever I'm doing. Say I talk on the phone, I'll talk on the phone and dial the phone with my opposite hand. I'll keep my change in my left pocket instead of my right pocket. Open a door with my left instead of my right. Zip a zipper or tie a shoe with the opposite hands. And, you know, just trying to remember to do all those things in the course of your daily routine, you know, it adds a little exercise to your brain, it seems.
Well, what do you think, Asena?
Well, that's a kind of interesting strategy. I don't know of too much research that would support that specific strategy, but the general idea that you try to do some new things to
yeah.
basically bring new challenges, new cognitive challenges into your life is an idea that's getting a lot of attention. The notion would be that you may be creating new or more diverse neural networks that might permit your brain to be better able to learn and retain new information. We're kind of at an exploratory stage with beginning to understand what might be the best ways to do that. But I think that's kind of a novel idea that you've come up with to keep yourself attending. Now, let me comment, though, that for people who do have brain disorders, such as beginning Alzheimer's disease or maybe a post-stroke syndrome, sometimes the more routinized everyday necessities, necessary behaviors become, in a way you should capitalize on that, because then you can use your remaining attention and brain power to focus on more difficult tasks. So at a certain point, kind of relying on the habitual ways to do things can become an asset, especially among people who have brain conditions or disorders.
You have something called the 1-2-3 of brain power that relates here to what Rich is talking about. Let's go. What are those main preventive actions, I guess we're calling them?
Right. This just brings in the kind of general lifestyle question of, are there things that we can be doing in our everyday lifestyle that might increase the chances that we'll be able to stay sharp as we age? And there's also the question of, are there things we can be doing that will prevent Alzheimer's disease? disease? And those are sort of two different questions, I think, to some extent. But there is by now an accumulating weight of evidence from observational studies. And these are naturalistic studies where we look at what people are doing in their ordinary lives and then see how well they're holding up cognitively as they age. And there are three dimensions of everyday life that seem to be connected to staying cognitively healthy. And one of them is the realm of physical exercise. And a number of these observational studies now show that individuals who engage routinely in physical exercise, particularly of the type that we might call aerobic exercise,
sure,
that makes you breathe a little harder and get your heart rate up, that those individuals do tend to score better on cognitive tests over time as they age. And some studies also show a reduced prevalence of Alzheimer's disease for a given age. Another important area is the whole mental equivalent of that, the mental activity or exercise realm. And again, the preponderance of observational studies suggest that people who are more mentally active, who have a more engaged and demanding cognitive lifestyle, tend to hold up cognitively better as they age. And then finally, the whole area of social connectedness. People who have larger and more diverse social networks, again, seem to, at least in an observational sense, have an edge with staying cognitively healthy as they age.
So those are the three.
Now, there's a big leap, and I'm sure you're going to come to this, but there's kind of a leap between what we see observationally and knowing for sure that making an improvement in those any of those realms will protect us. And for that, we need a different kind of study, and the clinical trials study, and they're really just getting started in these areas.
But, you know, as I look at those three areas, physically active, you know, challenging your brain, crossword puzzles, go to lectures, concerts, maybe museums or whatever, and then being socially active, regardless of whether you're trying to stave off memory loss, those are just good things for living.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, I think it's fine to encourage people and support people in, you know, revving up in each of those areas to the extent that their lifestyle and interest permits, because the downside of it, the drawbacks are truly negligible. And there are proven health benefits in other realms of each of these things.
And Rich, thanks again for calling. I want to give Wendy in Oshkosh a chance to join us. Wendy, hello.
Hi, fascinating topic. I'm in my early 50s, and I'm already, like, forgetful. I wonder, I have high cholesterol, which I just started taking a statin drug, and I had heard that sometimes the brain kind of gets clogged up with plaque, and is that associated with a higher risk of Alzheimer's? And also, I'm getting ready to take a French class. I'm wondering if that's going to help me learning a new language, if that would be good for my brain.
Well, kudos for you for enrolling in a foreign language course. I think that that is the type of new learning where, you know, it may have advantages for you in terms of keeping your brain sharp. Are connections, again, between elevated cholesterol and increased risk of dementia in older ages. And we don't know yet whether that's entirely due to the fact that people may have some vascular brain changes that are going along, or if it may even predispose to Alzheimer's itself. So attending to this now when you're in your early 50s by getting treatment for things like elevated cholesterol is probably number one on the list in terms of preventive strategies, is if you have a diagnosed condition, especially in the cardiovascular realm or diabetes, to attend to that now to the best of available medical strategies is very likely to have payoff for you in terms of cognitive aging. And I'll be curious to know how you find that taking a new language course. It might be a little humbling the first week or two in class if you're like me, but if you can stick with it, I think you'll have some benefits.
Merci.
Merci. All right. Kathy and Madison, it's your turn now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, my sister is 52 years old, and 1 year ago she was diagnosed with an atypical form of Alzheimer's. At that time, they advised her to have more tests, specifically a PET scan, so they could narrow down the diagnosis and then have some, I guess, information about how to go with medicines. However, my sister doesn't want any part of this. Mm-hmm. She is just very, very angry and very upset and refuses, actually, to continue to see the doctors who she thinks are just kind of, you know, against her. And I'm getting really worried because her symptoms are getting worse. And I'm just wondering how important, you know, like how much time do we have and how important is it really for her to get this medicine? Will it really make any difference or is it better for her to just sort of play this out in the way that, you know, she's playing it out, which is to kind of reject it?
Well, again, without knowing specifically what she's been diagnosed with, I wouldn't know specifically what medicine that they mm-hmm. are suggesting. The currently available FDA-approved medications, I think all of us in the field wish they had a stronger benefit on average than they do. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, our reading of the literature is that these medications do have some benefit for a significant proportion of the people who take them.
Okay.
And the chief benefit is in slowing the course of decline.
Okay.
It's not the kind of medication which you would typically expect to show an improvement, a dramatic improvement within, let's say, the first weeks or months that a person takes it. Its benefit, rather, is measured in how fast a person may have negative or downward changes compared to if they were not on the medication. And that can be a tough sell. I mean, that can be a hard sell to someone who is already doubtful that they should be bothering with this. But I think especially at that age, the more you can do, I would recommend considering every possible supportive approach, including, you know, using whatever lifestyle changes you can to stay mm-hmm. physically healthy and to keep some mental stimulation in appropriate ways. That the more you can support her in doing this, the better.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, and good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Kathy in Viola wonders about the study you mentioned earlier involving people between 40 and 65 who had a close family member diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Her husband's both parents died of Alzheimer's. Their husband's very sharp, but wondering if you could mention the study again mm-hmm. and how she could access the information to possibly
sure.
participate.
Yeah, this project is called the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. It's the RAP project. And you could read more about that by going to the website for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. And that is www.medsch.wisc.edu/WAI. Or you can just Google the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute and that will come up. That'll be easier.
That'll be easier.
But that will explain the RAP study. And we are still doing some limited recruitment into that study. You know, please check it out.
Let's see. Christopher, I believe, in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, yeah. Okay, let me give you a little background. I'm a 48 white male, and I'm suffering from a short-term memory loss.
Okay, and you're interested in finding out more about this, or?
Yeah, a clinical study's going on I could be a part of.
Okay.
I definitely have a brain chemistry disorder, yeah, and I want to know what I can do for it.
All right.
Okay. Again, it might depend on what the problem is underlying your memory problem. What has your regular physician told you on this?
I don't have one. I'm on Social Security disability.
Okay. Mm. Well, certainly a good starting point would be to have a conversation with a family practitioner or internist, you know, a primary care person to sort of take a look at your general medical condition, because there can be all sorts of specific medical causes of memory problems, especially is important to look at for a person your age. That really would be the best first step before you were looking at research investigations.
And through Chris is on SSI, so mm-hmm. he's probably would have access to medical care, would he not?
I would assume so, and your county's Health and Human Services program would be a very good stopping point on that if you had any questions on that.
So take a look under Milwaukee County in the phone book and look under what would be under Public Health?
Department of Health Services, yes.
Department of Health Services. Chris, and see if you can get some help and direction in that way. And thank you very much and good luck. Thank you for calling. Don in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Don, hello.
Yes, hello. I recently turned 86, and except for a severe peripheral neuropathy, I'm not diabetic, but have peripheral neuropathy, I consider myself in pretty good shape cognitively. I've been a big fan of ginkgo biloba for many years, and I just wondered if you have any opinions concerning that.
Well, congratulations on being 86 and being sharp, and that's what we all aspire to. And whatever you're doing, you must be doing something right, is one thing I'd say. On the ginkgo biloba, this has been mentioned as a sort of supplement that might be relevant to helping brain function over time. I would have to say that, for example, there was a very recent controlled randomized trial that came out. It's published in the November issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Steve Dukoski is the principal investigator on that. This was a large multi-site trial conducted here in the United States, which found no benefit from ginkgo biloba as a supplement for cognitively healthy individuals. And I'd have to say the research evidence is not strong. Although anecdotally, I've talked to a number of people who feel it benefits.
All right. Thank you for calling, Don. Mary in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question regarding this person's opinion about toxic chemicals being the cause of Alzheimer's, such as aluminum and mercury.
What do you think?
Well, the aluminum question has been considered a lot over time, and at this point, it's not considered a strong contender as a causal agent. There is excess accumulation of aluminum in the brain of people who have Alzheimer's disease, but it's generally viewed more as a byproduct of a more fundamental breakdown in the brain. Now, mercury, of course, can be neurotoxic, but I don't know of literature that specifically links it as a common cause of Alzheimer's disease.
All right. And Patty in Eau Claire, quick question from you.
Quick question. Does long-term use of SSRIs affect memory? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right.
That's an excellent question.
Antidepressants we're talking about.
Yes, we're talking about a specific class of antidepressants. We do know that with major depression, many people have complaints about their attention and memory ability, and taking relevant medications such as SSRIs can be beneficial for people who, in terms of memory function, for people who have serious depression problems. Over over the long term, I think it's hard to disentangle use of antidepressants from the condition itself. There are studies that do suggest that serious recurring depression over the course of a lifespan may be a risk factor for dementia, may somewhat slightly increase your risk of dementia. Disentangling what's the treatment versus what's the disease themselves from this, I wouldn't want to try to say at this point.
Well, I would like to say that I thank you very much for being with us today. Asina, the time has flown by, and I think if people want to learn more about the studies we've talked about and or their own families and so forth who are maybe affected by Alzheimer's, go to the website. It's probably the best, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. If you just put that into a search engine, it's going to pop up. And I want to thank again Asina LaRue for being with us. Thank you very much.
I'd like to also mention the website for the Alzheimer's Association chapters. And again, if you just Google Alzheimer's Association, that is another great source of information.
Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.